let's start with our, I said 20 minutes on the Rabbi Levine article. So let's spend 20 minutes just analyzing his presentation. And then we'll turn into Poel Mishalo, who Ochel Mishal Shemayim, who Ochel. That's going to relate a little bit to the honorary article that we saw earlier. I'm just going to also pull up a source sheet that I want to share. I'll do it separately. It's fine. So here, I'm sharing my screen. I'm going to pull up. This is the book, by the way. It's this book, Economics and Jewish Law, Halachic Perspectives by Rabbi Levine. As I said, like Rabbi Levine is a very big Talmud Chacham. I think he's a musmach of RJJ. And he wrote like several books on Jewish law and economics. There's one, he has a PhD in economics from NYU. And he was the chair of YU's economic department for many years until he passed away a few years ago. In one of the introductions to his books, he says that he sees himself as like working in this field of like the Jewish version of law and economics. Anybody know what like law and economics is? Shua, you could tell us probably a little bit about it if you're able to share quickly.
Yeah, I don't know. Itamar, you'll tell me whether I'm like correct in like a high level description of it, because I think I probably have encountered it more in the substance. Though I did take a law and economics course at Yeshiva University with Professor Grivianis, for anyone who's lucky enough to experience that. And I think I probably still have my book somewhere unopened if anyone wants to buy it from me. But basically, law and economics is a theory that kind of like economic realities, probably structures as well, but more kind of like first principles inform and kind of like are the foundation of a lot of what law is in a descriptive sense, and a lot of what law should be in a prescriptive sense. So like I came out of the University of Chicago and the former dean of Yale Law School.
It's Coase. Coase is the Chicago figure,
right?
Coase.
This
paper, The Problem of Social Costs, deals with the nature of the firm, like economies of scale, I think is his term.
Yeah. Well, Coase was an economist.
Yes. Right?
Coase theorem is like a very, very important economics thing for anyone.
Well, it's really a theory of law,
right?
But it, from the economic side, correct?
Right. What's his name? The Yale guy.
Calabresi?
Calabresi. Guido, who's one of the nicest people I've ever met in my life. He kind of, I think, came at it a little bit more from the, he was a judge, like he still is a judge on the Second Circuit, and came at it like more from a legal perspective. But basically the idea is that efficiency is the like goal of most economic theory, either like creating efficiency or like moving toward efficiency. And the idea was that law should facilitate. Check that out.
Look at Guido.
Guido?
See. Calabresi's on here. See that? He's a lot.
Very cool.
Yeah.
That's so random. He has a lot of affinity for the Jews. Apparently, like his family, people say he's Jewish. He's not Jewish, but his like Italian family for like hundreds of years, like married with Italian Jews. So he was my
Ed Burns, who was the executive dean of Einstein for many years, might still be. He used to say that in the Bronx, if you have an Italian last name, you're Bechezkas Jewish, because mother's probably Jewish. But if you have a Jewish last name, you're Bechezkas non-Jewish. Because
that's amazing.
You have a Jewish father.
So, yeah. But yeah, I think that that's probably the correct way to say it, right? Which is that law, when we analyze it, the analysis we should use is kind of like what efficiency is it attempting to create? And when we attempt to create law, the question we should be asking is how can this most efficiently affect our like social reality?
Exactly. So it's like one of the most important commitments is that the normative position that the law should be fashioned to increase economic efficiency. Like that's the goal of the law. And you get these figures like, you know, Coase is seen as a foundational figure, Cal Bracey, Judge Posner, who's also in Chicago, at Chicago. You know, it's like the purpose of the law is economic efficiency. And then you get people who like are critical of this movement, like Dworkin. Remember like the Dworkin article that I sent around on is wealth a value? You know, the kind of moral philosophers who say like, what's so important about efficiency? Like, so you could save like more money, people are a little happier. Like, what's the intrinsic moral value in that unless you're some sort of utilitarian, right? So like Dworkin says like the notion that courts should decide cases in a manner that's going to increase overall economic efficiency is just like a fetishism with wealth. He says, and if you're going to argue that like wealth is like an important proxy for getting at these other goods, like healthcare and education, then courts should just work towards like, you know, maximizing access to healthcare and education, not through the proxy of wealth. So like the criticism of the law and economics school is that you have to hold so stark from like economic efficiency as an intrinsic value to believe that like that's the goal of the law overall, that the law is here to increase economic efficiency. As Dworkin said in that piece, Zakaria, do you remember that quote about the fetish for the green paper? Remember that?
Yeah, it was excellent. That was
it's a good musser, right?
Near the beginning. No.
Yeah, I don't have it open in front of me. But like, I mean, that's like the core.
I aged up in my Hanukkah share from tomorrow and also last week. Tami the Chachoven, Mimonim Chavivan Alev, Yoser Migufa.
Yeah, it's interesting. You have to figure out how exactly that squares with this idea. Like, V'chol Nafshcha, V'chol Mo'odecha, right? Yeah, there's a lot. Those questions are at the core of this analysis, meaning the Dworkin's criticism is there's no intrinsic value to wealth. So it seems crazy to think that the purpose of the legal system is to maximize efficiency, right? That's just, you're pursuing the wrong good. And Dworkin says, if you think that's a value in and of itself, then you have a fetish for a green paper, right? That was his criticism. Instead, he thinks like the law should aim to, you know, these more moral considerations, whatever they might be. So I think that's to frame the general discussion. When you come to Jewish law, so you have a book like Economics and Jewish Law by Rabbi Levine, and, you know, Free Enterprise and Jewish Law is his other book, and he's interested in the intersection of economics and Jewish law. Like, you, the thing you have to ask yourself is it plausible that efficiency is going to loom so large in Jewish law and Jewish thought, right? That's kind of the background question. My intuition is like, no, property and like efficiency, these aren't like big Jewish values. They don't loom so large within the Jewish like legal system. Rabbi Levine, and I'll take, yeah, Gabe, you have a thought on this?
I just want to ask a clarifying question. Does the economics and law school believe that that's always the function of law and always has been the function of law? Right, so it's sort of a recent development in legal theory that law has moved to promote efficiency.
So there's usually, they say there's like a descriptive component of the theory, which says something like common law judges have always like sought to maximize efficiency, like going back to like the King's Bench in England, whatever it is. And then there's the normative leg, which says that, yeah, like judges ought to strive to do this because of like efficiency. So they usually make both claims, or yeah. You know, I think this is like a really interesting question that Shua is, you know, raising about, you know, Tamin Chamim, like Mamonam Chaviv Malem Yosem Yigufam, things like that. Whether it's the case that in halacha these economic considerations really do loom large. Rabbi Levine's like life's, in his early works, what he does in all his books is he tries to show like that there's like this underlying economic consideration to all these laws of Choshen Mishpat. He thinks that Yored L'toch Umanuso Shel Chaveiro is like aiming at some sort of efficient equilibrium of provision of goods. He thinks that Yored L'toch Umanuso Shel Chaveiro Mashbicho, Yored L'toch Sadeh Chaveiro Mashbicho, and that has to do with like recouping positive externalities, which is about recouping, like it's an economic consideration about incentivizing people to confer benefits on others so that like society will be maximally efficient. So you have to like buy into like the halacha caring about economic efficiency in all of these cases. And I think that makes for like a really interesting question in and of itself. I just want to point out, unless Shua, you want to get a point in first.
I was just saying, does he address Hafsaga Skvul at any point? That's not like the most anti-competitive, like the most classic anti-competitive.
So he thinks that that's what's interesting about his thing. He thinks there's a way to spin it as pro like efficiency, which will, he actually does it a little bit in this article, but a lot of his stuff is like, it's like how to get the right tension between protection and non-protection. And you know, he argues that like the halacha arrives at the efficient result. So that's right. I mean, there's a little bit of like a historical tendentiousness here, which doesn't bother me so much, but I know Gabe mentioned that. It's like, oh, like, does it make sense that the Rishonim are thinking in terms of designing the law efficiently? But then there's like the normative issue. Does it make sense even that the halacha fashions all of these Koshei Mishpat rules around that result? Zolt, do you have a hand on this?
Yeah, is he making like a broad argument in like all parts of halacha? All parts of like Koshei Mishpat he thinks this is true? Or like, is he going to limit it to like only certain things, but like Torah law is not going to be as expansive? Like we discussed and we did like Bava Kama a few years ago, like talked about this a lot. Like it's not like it's obvious you can make this same argument in like all the different spheres.
Totally.
Like Koshei Mishpat.
Yeah, that's a good point. I would just say that he himself, like this is I don't almost like this is like the theme. This is his analysis of all these sugyas is through the economic lens. So like any sugya that he covers, he looks at it this way almost.
Like consistently.
Consistently, exactly. And there's no self-conscious assessment of his method. Like he doesn't say like, oh, I'm assuming that economic efficiency is a value in Judaism and the Rishonim we're thinking in these terms. He just kind of just says like, here's the economic principle and here's the halachos that instantiate it. Yeah. So let me share, I just want to make this point here. It is an interesting question. I think this is what Shua was getting at. You know, about how much Jewish law does care about efficiency. People like to point to the idea of Prusbel, you know, Hiskin Hillel, Shirosh, and Nunu Amila Halvozezeh. She's Metakin Prusbel. I don't know, is that an economic consideration? Or it's more of just like that he wanted to make sure that people are Mekayim the mitzvah of in Kesef Tilves Ami.
Why can't it just be because he didn't want people to be over on the Isser that he literally quotes in the next line?
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, of not lending money before Shemitah. So it's not obvious that like the, you know, in trying to incentivize people to lend money, that he's interested in like the circulation of credit for the economy as a good in and of itself, rather than like the particular mitzvah of Hishamer Lecha Pentiyam Levavcha B'Lial, whatever. The Gemara in Gittin is another example. The Gemara in Memtes, you know, talks about why a Balchov is Gove Bebenonis, even though Midoraisa, he's only Gove Beziboris. And the Gemara says, because of this concern about some Noel Delas Bifnei Lovin. And the question there is like, what's the value of Noel Ni'ilas Delas? Like, why? What's the concern of Ni'ilas Delas Bifnei Lovin? Is that a kind of economic consideration, or is that something more basic? Meaning, is the idea here like efficiency? Like the Federal Reserve has to figure out like how much, like what credit rates should be, what interest rates should be to stimulate the economy, or is the idea here more like people are starving and they need to be able to borrow money to get through the month. And so the halacha wants to make sure that people are lending them money to provide their basic needs. So it's not clear here whether this is like an economic concern in the investment sense of efficiency. You want to make sure there's capital to go around to stimulate investment and efficient production. Or if this is like a narrower concern, like, we need to make sure that people could borrow money to pay their credit card bill for their groceries. See what I'm saying?
It definitely still sounds like economic either way. Like there's still certainly an economic concern here, even if it's of a narrower scope.
Yeah, that's true. But like the thing that's underwriting the narrower economic concern is just like not economics, right? It's like the basic dignity of a person or survival. Yeah.
It's much easier to read this as a moral consideration than an economic consideration.
Yeah, that's my inclination also. Although it really is a question of like what the empirical reality there is. Like what exactly is the issue at hand in Noel Dahl's Pifnei-Lovin? You also have the example.
You could read that. I think you could probably read that in the first Gemara that you quoted from Gittin. You know, sort of like, yeah, fine. Maybe it's just because, you know, he's concerned about this, like, you know, sort of really narrow Isser. But it could also be that, like, yeah, part of what the Isser is getting at is that, like, yeah, Shemitah shouldn't get in the way of, like, you know, there being enough capital for people to, like, live normally and, you know, and borrow if they need to.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
It doesn't need to be a purely, like, theological thing about bitachon.
Correct. I agree with that. You know, other examples that are relevant to consider, let's see, is that, you know, this really comes out of Gemara and Sanhedrin. The Rambam quotes it in Malva Beloba Yedzayin Tess, how we do away with Drisha V'Chakira in Dine Mominis, in order Shalotinel Dalas Bifnei Lovin. So again, you get that same phrase about Nilas Dalas Bifnei Lovin, and but the same ambiguity also, right? So the concern here is that if the burden of proof for a creditor is so high and it's difficult to establish he lent somebody money, then there'll be a chilling effect that he won't want to lend money anymore. So Chazal just did away with the Drisha B'Chakira. They lowered the threshold of evidence to recover a loan. But then again, the question is, what loans are we talking about here, right? Investment loans to stimulate the economy, or just in the narrower sense of making sure that people have access to capital to satisfy their basic needs. Okay. Now, I think all these sugyas are ambiguous. It sounds true. It sounds like you have some examples you wanted to call to the, about like, you know, that would maybe motivate like the halachic case, the halachic interest in economics. Like you're talking about Tamei Chachamim, Chaviven Aleihem Mamonam.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that those are necessarily, those are like, they're hard to know how to interpret, right? They're not necessarily, they don't necessarily show up in the halachic context. Like, I guess, like you said, B'chol Melodacha, right? That Gemara in Brachos. The Tamil Chachom Chaviv Melayos Rigufon is the Gemara in Chulin about Pachim Tanim, right? Like that Rashi quotes last week.
Yeah, this was Parsha.
Yeah. Last week's Parsha, right? So, That's what we learned from Yaakov being closer for the Pachim Ktanim. I think it probably shows up in we talked about the Gemara in Tainus about like the Chizkiya
Bar Abba. Yeah, Levine's got. I want to talk more about that because Rabbi Levine has something to say about it problematically that I'm gonna weigh in on.
Right. So I don't know that I have necessarily an encyclopedic knowledge of all the places where this comes up, but it's not like.
I like how you qualified that necessarily. You don't think you necessarily have the possibility that you do have that encyclopedic knowledge.
Yeah, I mean, whatever. We have to leave some things to the imagination. But I think it at least comes up frequently enough for us to consider that it's not like a throwaway line.
Yeah. You have things I would just point us to, like Atorah Chasam Amonim Shel Yisrael. I don't have this, but you know, like Gemara in Yuma about like why the kalfi was made of wood. On Yom Kippur rather than gold or silver, because that Torah Chasam on Am Shel Yisrael. But then again, it's hard to know what value is that, right? Just like it shouldn't waste money on like gratuitous things, or is that like saying like, oh no, like there's something valuable in and of itself about what Rabbi Levine is going to call the least cost method.
Yeah, I would say one thing I've been thinking about, and I am interested to hear what you think, is that I think like the focus on mammon is interesting, right? Like, if you had come to me out of the blue, I don't know if this is right. I'm not like a semantician, but like if you had come to me and said like the Torah is like capitalistic and it cares about property, I would have been like, okay, like in like ancient, like land is like an extension of yourself type thing. But like these chazals are not about land, right? They're about like pachim tanim, they're about mammon. They're about like the thing that we would think of as like most defeasible from like a you know strength of ownership, personhood, like extension perspective. So
yeah, it's interesting. That's like, it's like cash almost, right?
Yeah, it's like the thing you would think is like least important.
Dworkin's green paper. Yeah, it's I don't, again, it's interesting, like what Mamon connotes, like does Mamon connote like the abstract coin, it like the currency, or does Mamon connote like your acquisitions?
I mean, it's the great Avodah Zarah, Mammon.
We'll see in our sugya actually if the Achronim, I mean, Reb Chaim leaves this. I don't know if anybody got to Reb Chaim yet in Hochas Me'ilah. Reb Chaim talks about like it's like a din Mamon. And you know, for me, this is like one of the most frustrating formulations. You'll see that Yonas Elam also, which I'll add to the first, that uses this din mamon thing. And like all the Achronim run at me, like, what is a din mamon? Right? It's like what's that supposed to connote? But we'll get to that in short order. Okay. So Rabbi Levine in his article here on page 159. Go ahead, Gabe.
Before, like, once we're in the world of theory, I'm biting my tongue a little bit because I don't think these are ambiguous contexts. I think they're very clearly non-economic contexts. But you're with me?
I'm with you.
I'm curious, like, if, like, anybody has a guess as, like, what's motivating Rabbi Levine to sort of fit efficiency into halakha. Like, is there, like, can we historicize this? It's like, there's some broader, I don't know, like, to make halakha feel current, to sort of use... prove that halakha is capitalist and antisocial. I don't know. I can't imagine what would motivate somebody to read these different sugyot in this way.
Yeah, like what's underlying his project, other than that he's like a PhD in economics, and you know, if you're a PhD in economics, the natural thing to do is to. Yeah, it's interesting. What do you, Evan? You got a thought on this or?
Yeah, from my like limited amount of like history, wasn't there like a big like push for efficiency and this like this idea of like the ultimate efficiency coming out of like post-war America, or like post-World War II world, or like, you know, boom of like sort of this idea of like I don't remember what it is. I think Ayn Rand quotes something about that, like after the war, everyone was very, or before, everyone wasn't efficient, and then turn of the century, everyone's like locked in on efficiency and on like creating the ultimate, like perfect machine and this kind of like zeitgeist. So like maybe it's a little more social, and also like he was like studied economics, so obviously that's gonna influence him.
I think there does seem to be like a zeitgeist component here. You know, this is, you know, it's mid-20th century America, it's laissez-faire capitalism, like post-war world. Just seemed like this was like the machinery of like capitalism, and it was seen as like a big moral breakthrough. Milton Friedman, post-Reagan America.
All right, I was right. It is a thing. It's called the efficiency movement.
Oh, yeah?
It's
like, you know, it's like, I guess it's like, you know, if you grew up in Berlin in the early 20th century, you were a neo-Kantian. And, you know, if you grew up in America in the 20th century, then you were a Milton Friedman laissez-faire capitalist. And then you say, oh, like halakha is getting at these values also, maybe.
Yeah. That's the direction I was speculating in as well.
Yeah. Yeah, great. It's interesting. It's helpful. Yeah, I mean, to me, it's fascinating. I'm like, but yeah, we'll look through his particular analysis in a second. But yeah, that's a good point, Gabe. Yoni, you have a hand on this before we get into the substance?
Oh yeah, I was just gonna say that like in Achanami, like I don't know his background. Definitely possible Rabbi Levine is like personal background like plays a role in like how he like theorizes halakha. But I think it's like valuable. I mean, you mentioned this in the beginning, but I think it's valuable that I think there's been a bigger, larger push in recent times to try like. Organizing Choshen Mishpat as like a system of law instead of just like a bunch of halachot that are like interspersed and like relate to a system of law that like really hasn't been fully used in, you know, centuries, if not millennia. And I think like there's like a push that like once you're going to create a theory of law and try relating it to like modern law systems. So then, yeah, you might talk about like, you know, certain conceptions of law nowadays. And I don't think it's such crazy to assume that like halakha certainly has like certain aspects that like incorporate a certain like economic efficiency principles within it. Like, I mean, obviously, like, the problem with his theories is that, like, it just, you might take it to an extreme, and, like, you might have to differentiate between, like, certain areas of halacha where clearly are more economic efficiency concerns than others. But, like, I don't think that disqualifies that, like, his work is like, poorly motivated. Like, I don't think that's a fair critique.
Yeah, I think we should evaluate the work based off its content, not based off whatever motivates the project.
But yeah, but I'm saying even, like, I might forget, like, his motivations. I think that, like, it's, like, we should be careful not to make broad strokes here that, like, oh, clearly, like, I don't think I agree with Gabe or with you that, like, I don't think it's so obvious that, like, the kind of Slovin is, you know, it's so obviously a moral question. Like, I think you're overstating that a lot. Like, I don't think it's so obvious in any of those contexts that there's, like, a fear specifically that someone's poor and not going to be able to get a loan. Like, where does Gmar mention anything about poverty in those contexts?
Right. I hear. I'm open. I think both are possibilities. I was agreeing with Graves that my inclination is that this is where that's at bar in the Gemara. But I agree that the Gemara could be read pulled in either direction. What exactly Shmuel Dallas Bifnei Lovin is. I agree with that.
Yoni, I think it's clear that the psukim are explicit that the lova, the paradigmatic lova, is an ani. And the paradigmatic.
Sure, but that doesn't imply that the takana that the chami make for specific rules about halvot are specifically because they're dealing with poor people. Like, that's not. I don't think that's so obvious. Maybe ultimately what motivates an economic efficiency model is because we care about the poor people. But we still want an economy that, you know, moves. We believe it trickles down, or whatever form of language you know, economic theory you believe in.
Whichever ideology of brainwashing. No, I'm just kidding.
I mean, I'm not a Milton Friedman supporter. I'm just saying I understand, like, how you could do that within halacha.
Yeah, no, I think that's what's so interesting about this. I agree. I also agree with your point, Yoni, that there is, like, a Mishpat Ivri project going on here. It's like there's this attempt to, like, figure out, like, the theory of, like, Choshen Mishpat and, like, what are the core values of Jewish law. And Rabbi Levine's trying to inject a lot of, like, oh, economics is a value within Jewish law. Shua, were you going to say something, or?
Not important. I think that, like, it's clear that there is this, like, orientation toward Lovazani. Like, I think that that's true in the Pesukim and in the Gemara. So at that point, you kind of just have to take it as is. Yeah. I don't know necessarily what that means, right? Like, whether that just reflected a reality consistent throughout history, or whether that's, like, a fundamental principle of it.
Yeah. But, I don't know if you caught this in the Rambam, the last Rambam in Perek. I think it was Yud Beis, I want to say. Maybe it's Yud Gimel. Avichas Chiras. When he says, Kashem Shemuzar Balabayish Shelo Ligzal. He just, like, switches, he puts in ani for poel, kach muzer ha ani shelo ligzol, like malachas. So there's an assumption that the poel's the ani, the lovez an ani. These are just kind of recurring assumptions that you know, the Gemara seems to have, the Rishonim have. You know, not worried about shua as the, you know, the poor ani poel.
Yeah, you don't know whether I'm going to call, but it's like a, like the underpinnings of the, like, if you believe that the halachic Torah system is, like, coherent and has, like first principles that cohere with each other, which I'm very willing to be convinced of this fact, but I have a hard time generating it for myself, then, like, you, like, start with things like Kilo Yachdalev Yomi Karef Haaretz, and that's, like, the fundamental, like, we're going to exist in a capitalistic system where this is, like, going to be true, and then, like, we're going to build around that, right? The other way, I guess, yeah. There's, like a very strange, I haven't seen this in a long time, but isn't there, like, a weird, also this is hilarious that this is coming up in Chaburah, but isn't there, like, a weird back and forth between, like, Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish about Ki Yebuchav Yon and Ki Lo Yachdalev Yon? Like one day it's like there couldn't, but, like, the Rambam for sure says that, like, there's always going to be poverty.
Yeah, it's the Gemara in
Tainus
Shabbos about Kilo Yech Biglal Hadavar Azeh. That's a Galgal Achozer.
Yeah, I know there's a Gemara in Titus where there's like a back and forth. Like, I probably have not seen this since high school, right? But like, where one of them is like, one pasuk says kilo yachta levion, so like may as well learn Torah. Another one says lo fs kiyabcha evion, which is like maybe there will be, but like there doesn't have to be. But I know the Rambam in where the Rambam quotes Shmuel in Ben Olamazilimos Hamashiach Elashu and Malfios Bovad, says like, yeah, obviously there will still be poor people when Mashiach comes because kilo yachta levion. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, good. I want to take a look here at Rabbi Levine's analysis. With these larger questions looming in the background. So on page 159 of the article, and I'll pull up the article in a second, he says, this is right at the outset. Actually, no, let me go to the article first. So let me start. I have to. Do you see the article? Did it pop up on my screen or no? Okay, so I'm going to reshare. Here we go. So he says here, right in the outset, he says in this chapter, so the chapter is called Efficiency in Jewish Law. That's the name of the chapter. I think I scanned that. The book is Economics in Jewish Law. The chapter is Efficiency in Jewish Law. We're going to define the concept of efficiency. We'll then examine the extent to which Jewish law mandates the practice of efficiency as a religious duty. So he gives us this promissory note right at the outset saying that he's going to examine the extent to which Jewish law mandates the practice of efficiency as a religious duty, right? That's a really important question, right? Is there a religious duty to practice this kind of efficiency? That's how he sets up the purpose of the chapter here, okay? Then he tells us a little bit about efficiency. He says efficiency in economic theory, blah, 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 requires that the least cost method should be employed in the pursuit of a given objective. So it's like what you want to do, you have a certain goal, you have to achieve the goal with like the most efficient way, right? With the least costs. I just want to say just one general criticism of the piece is that he's not sensitive to like whether the objective itself is a worthy objective. He just says like, oh, here you have an objective, you have to pursue it efficiently. But you might think that one important question is whether the objective itself is a worthwhile pursuit. Zachary, did you ever
comment on that? Especially, yeah, he had a weird application of this to the farmer subsidy, where he categorizes, oh, obviously a valid terminal goal is a farmer subsidy, and now it's just a question of how do we go about providing a subsidy to farmers.
Yeah.
I think that's like an interesting one.
100%. But, and then look here, he says, he defines the sense of efficiency he's going to use. He says, this is allocational efficiency, which entails that markets search for required inputs at the least cost outlet. So like the products you use have to be like the least cost products or something like that. That's very important for his analysis of Baltashkes, which we're gonna look at in a second. Then he says there's another dimension of efficiency, which is like labor efficiency. What he calls this X efficiency, doesn't matter what the terms are, requires the firm to combine, coordinate, and direct the inputs available to it in a manner that would maximize output. That's really interesting. Just notice here that the duty, even in the way he sets it up, is on the firm, right? Like the firm has to be efficient. So the idea is that like if we're employed by Goldman Sachs, Goldman Sachs has to put our labor to work in the most efficient way. In his analysis and the substance of the chapter, notice that he starts talking about the workers' efficiency. Is that what you're going to say, Evan?
Yeah, exactly. He applies this, I think, later on, like to each person, and not necessarily even, I'm pretty sure I could be wrong, but like not even when like they're on the job, but about doing a job.
Yeah.
Which is a little odd.
Yeah, and I think this relates to his conflation of the efficiency question with the Gezel Malachto Shel Baal HaBayis question. One's like have you infringed on somebody else's property right? That's the Gezel or contractual right. That's the Gezel Malachto Shel Baal HaBayis question. The other one's a question of the value of efficiency per se. So I just want to flag that here at the outset. Okay. And then he says, okay, we don't have to write these formulations. So now he gets into the meat of his Jewish law. This is typical of his approach. He has like a page outlining some economic terms. And then he moves to like analyze a Stygia. You know, and like it's like nitty gritty Stygia analysis almost. So look what he does here. This, I think, is the most important part of the piece. Efficiency as treated in Jewish law. Notice he immediately goes to Baal Tashchis. What did he think of that? Of like, you know, going to Baal Tashchis as the place to look for efficiency, Evan?
On one hand, it seems pretty like solid ground to start on because it's possibly like literally about your input and output. But on the other hand, it's less economic and maybe more, you know, ecological, maybe, right? Like there's, or something about war, right? So it's about building, like sieging cities and stuff. So like it's not necessarily about workers. Like it's not.
Excellent. I think it's excellent. I think you're right to say, like, on the one hand, that seems like a brilliant place to start. Right, like, oh, like, where would we go to the halachas theory of efficiency? Let's look at Baal Tashchis, right? It's theory of waste. Now, a theory of waste is kind of the backside of a theory of efficiency. I think that was a pretty, as Shua said, like, in terms of spade work and, like, breaking the back of, like, just, like, where do you even go to, like, address this question? I think Rabbi Levine's kind of doing a really good job here. Well, on the other hand, what's that, Zacharia?
No, yeah, I don't know, just kind of, like, along those lines, I think another interesting detail about Tashchis is pretty unique. Is one of the few, I don't know if you call Choshen Mishpat, at least monetary halachos that are a duty to yourself, not involving a second party. And therefore, that might be looking what he's looking for.
Yeah, exactly. It's you know what's sometimes called like a simple directive. It's not owed to anybody. It's just like an obligation. So it can't be like there's no Gezel Malachto Shabala bias issue going on here, right? So it's a nice place to think just about pure efficiency. Like when I started here in the back of my mind, I'm like, oh, really? Like, could you squeeze efficiency out of Baal Tashchis? That's not like my sense of Baal Tashchis, right? So I think that intuition, we'll see that play out in a second, right? Like is he interpreting Baal Tashchis in the right way? Anybody else have thoughts just on Regal Achas? Like when you saw him go to Baal Tashchis, did you think like, oh, this makes sense? Or do you think this is implausible?
No. Somebody else? Like the you know, sort of the Baal Tashchis like seemed to me to be more of less of like a din, to use the terminology that you weren't, you know, fond of, less of like a din mamon, like to fall more in terms of like the, you know, chasima shor side of the spectrum and less, you know, on the zechus achilas povel side of the spectrum, which, you know, might be like, you know, might make it, you know, less of a place that you can actually extrapolate from in terms of, you know, monetary efficiency as like a din mamon.
Yeah, interesting. You know, it's like to take Shua's point, you know, in some sugyas the Gemara talks about mamon is pretty absent from Baal Tashchis discussions. I were talking about more like these resources, you know, construed like fruit trees and things it seems less about waste and more about like particular objects of importance. But Shua?
Yeah, I actually do find this compelling. I don't know how far to take it, but I think that like just like self-contained to the sugya of Baal Tashchis, it is it's not, if you just looked in the psukim, this is not what you would expect the Gemara and the Rishonim to do, right? Like you would think of this as like a v'yaseh tielech halazenecha, like a one-off strange, like esoteric halacha about like ki adam etz hasadeh, like that makes it sound like it's like unique. And all of a sudden the Gemara comes in and it's like, actually, it's really not. It's just expressing this like principle about like, don't waste things. And it's like fairly expansive and like not ki adam etz hasadeh. And so, I think that is compelling. Like the fact that the way the Rambam formulates it, like really makes it sound like it's this like first principle of like,
okay,
like relating to like objects.
Yeah. I think the interesting question is borne out by the Dinim. That's like that's the question. And that's what I want to look at right now. Let's just take Zacharia and then Zolti, and then we'll get into the substantive.
Yeah, I think, I don't know. I thought Ari Levin brought a very good point with regards to this, that regards to the object value distinction that Baal Tashchis applies to money. once you say that, it's just kind of surprising. I don't know. I really think that does shift things like in the direction Shu was saying.
Okay, good. Good. We'll see that in a second. We'll see his analysis. That's a good point. Zolt?
Yeah, I mean, it seems to me like VeltageScript, like it addresses efficiency or like waste in the sense that it's like, to me, it's like there's a moral imperative to be efficient. Not that we would necessarily want like a system of law to be efficient, but more it's just like there's a moral imperative of sorts to try being efficient as much as possible and not to waste. Like I feel like we're conflating different things here. I think that's like there's certainly an appeal to efficiency, but not efficiency in terms of like that law should be organized only around efficiency. Like that should be the binding.
I agree. I think law. Yeah, but he wants to take small steps, right? So I think first, like, if he could show in this, to borrow Shu's phrase, like, this foundational first principle sense that the halacha cares about this strong sense of efficiency, that's an important step towards the stronger goal, right, or the stronger claim, right? So he doesn't have to do everything at once. I'd be satisfied if he kind of took this first step in the right way. So Zolti, I agree with you. I'm just saying I think it's fine for him to wade in slowly.
All right.
Okay. Gabe?
How different would this project have looked if instead of saying, like, reading efficiency into Baltashkes, he applied Baltashkes to efficient market concerns? Like, we extrapolated principles from Baltashkes and borrowed from them and brought them to bear on economic considerations. Is that a different project, or is that the same thing?
Interesting. I'm not sure. You definitely get the sense that he's doing a lot of reading in his analysis. I'm not sure how the project would look if it was reversed. Interesting question. Let's look at the meat of his analysis here. I want to make a few points. So starts off, I think, pretty nicely. He says, quotes the general din, quotes the psukim of Baltashkes, which is fine. He says, by the way, an analysis of the biblical prohibition provides a basic strand in extrapolating Judaism's attitude toward both allocational and ex-efficiency. Okay, so he thinks that like we're going to shed light on those two senses of efficiency through Baltashkes. He talks about the application of Baltashkes. The prohibition extends the discretion of anything beneficial to mankind. The Talmud applies it to breaking a utensil, tearing a garment, destroying an animal, causing a lamp to burn faster than its normal rate of fuel consumption. That's all fine. Okay, so he talks about some of the extensions. By the way, I do want to mention, there's a Rashi in Bava Kamma where he seems to say that like Nezikin, the Isser Nezikin is Baltashkes. That's also very important if you're interested in the scope of Baltashkes. We saw this in Bava Kamma. Definitely Zolti and Yakir should remember this. And the Isser Lahazik. But I'll add it to the Makor Rashi. It's like an interesting application of Baltashkes that the Isser Lahazik flows from Baltashkes, wasting resources. Okay, then he says, he's right, he quotes here, the Rambam, Baltashkes involves an action carried out with no useful intent that results in destruction of some material substance. Okay. There's no malchus, the Rambam says, unless the action can be characterized as purposeless destruction. That's a huge qualification, purposeless destruction. Now, even that's a very weak translation of the original. Did anybody look up the Rambam? What does the Rambam actually say?
Derech hashchasa.
Yeah, derech hashchasa. I think derech hashchasa is more than just purposeless destruction. It's almost like... it's like gratuitous. It's like just like for the purpose of destruction, no? And to me, once you see that Rambam, I'll share my other source sheet here for a second. Once you look at the Rambam and he says derech hashchasa, to me that undermines a lot of the core argument here. Let me hear. You can see here in the way the Rambam has it. Lo encodes in Ilan Machol, blah blah blah. Lo asra Torah ela derech hashchasa. Now, to my mind, once the Rishonim qualify Baltashkes as being limited to cases of derech hashchasa, I think the hurdle to show that that Baltashchis is going to generate what he called allocational efficiency and X efficiency, meaning to put all resources, productive resources, in a manner that's going to maximize output and to use the least cost method, like, to me, that's a huge bridge to cross. So imagine, like, my house here that I live in is hugely inefficient. Like, my gas bill and my air conditioning bills are humongous because, like, literally you pump cold air or hot air into the house, it, like, goes out, like, through all the windows. Like, there's no insulation in this house. It's, like, really inefficient. So it's almost, like, maximally inefficient. But, like, is it derech hashchasa? Like, is there something like lo astra Torah la derech hashchasa? Am I, like, gratuitously, like, destroying things through, like, pumping all this air that goes out the window? I don't think so. So, like, to me, the gap between efficiency and derech hashchasa is a wide, wide gap. And Rabbi Levine's going to attempt to cross it through what he calls the sugya of me'ula bedamim. And I want to see if he's able to do so successfully.
This is kind of like what Z and I, when we were reading the article, we kind of like saw this as a difficulty in his later example when he talks about the toy production.
Yeah.
As sort of like, yeah, the toy production is like clearly an example of something that's like very inefficient. And you might even be like, you know, sort of the first round of toys you produce at a lower price, or you sell it at a lower price, because you want to like hook people on the new fad. So like, that's an example of something that's like, you know, very much not derech hashchata, even though it is very, you know, you're sort of like giving away money or, you know, destroying money.
Exactly. You could see like, he has like some technical term for that. Yeah.
Lost leader.
Yeah, the lost leader. That's right. Yeah, the lost leader. Yeah. Yeah, you see, like, he really thinks you could apply these dinim to those, like, very, like, specific cases of inefficiency that are clearly not derech hashchasa. So I think that's a really good point, Noah. That shows you that he wants to defend the strong thesis that halacha requires, remember, as a religious duty, this kind of allocational efficiency, what he calls X efficiency, etc. So look what he says. This is how he tries to motivate his case.
Can I just interject for a second? Like, is it so obvious that your interpretation of the Rambam is right?
Zul, do you have stock in the Rabbi Levine Corporation or something? What's going on?
No, I just have stock in like having an intellectually honest conversation.
All right, let's hear.
Like, is it so obvious that his reading of the Rambam is so wrong? And then, like, you're assuming derech hashchata implies that it has to be active and intentional destruction. But it could just be that the Rambam's interest in context is just differentiating between something which is destructive, meaning cutting down a tree for no good purpose, versus a tree which is, you know, cutting down a tree because that tree is damaging other trees or something of the sort. But that's the Rambam's context, in which case, like, it's not really about intentional versus unintentional. It's just about whether you're destroying something because you want to destroy it, or whether you're destroying it because it's because it's causing harm to others or you know, some other positive benefit.
I hear you're saying there's a more positive way of reading derech hashchasa, like in this just sense, as opposed to the way I'm reading it, which is like gratuitously destructive.
Yeah, like, I'm not sure it's so obvious to me that the Rambam wouldn't agree that there's like something wrong with like having your house without any like insulation.
Okay. So you're saying there's a way to read. Anybody else have thoughts on Zolti's reading of derech hashchasa?
I mean, even if you take the strong reading of the Rambam, you know, you just have the problem of the Rambam's example of Baltashchis does not include the case of the Pasuk. According to the Rambam, the Pasuk is not Baltashchis because he's using it for a siege engine. So I think that's, either you can't read the Rambam this way, or the Rambam is just like way overstating his case. And that's his next argument, is like, clearly the Gemara is dealing with trade-off situations, not just, okay, am I using this for fun? Am I breaking it for fun or for a purpose? Like, I don't know. I just feel like that line might be, derech hashchasa might be not so useful.
Okay. Look here at what Levine says. He says, well, the halacha clearly goes beyond purposeless destruction. Okay. And his argument is exactly as Zacharia said, that has to do with this case of cutting down a fruit tree. Okay. So the Torah says that if using the fruit tree is going to result in the creation of a higher value, this priority no longer holds. So does anybody understand the Mu'ula B'damim discussion? So the idea is that if you have a fruit tree and a non-fruit tree and you're building like a siege weapon, you have an obligation to use the non-fruit tree, right? That's the din in the Gemara, that's the din in the Pasuk. It's even just Pashup Shad in the Pasukim. So that's important, okay? Just to go back to the, I'm not sure why, I really have to get my, no, let me fix my source sheet here. I'm just gonna pull it onto the same screen. I think that'll be, make it easier for me to go back and forth. Just the language of the Pasukim, here we go. Oh, no, that's not what I want, sorry. Man, it's not letting me do it. Whatever. Okay. You know what I'll do? I'll do it this way. Here we go. Okay. The language of the Pesukim say, you should cut down the non-Eitz Machol. That's the idea, right? But he wants to say there's well, one second. He says here in the article, going back to it, on page 161, that if you take this interpretation of efficiency, then Baal Tashchis proscribes the transformation of material substance into something else unless a higher value is obtained. So it's like, it's, he wants to say, like, you could see from this case that it's more about efficiency, which I think Zachariah and Yoni is your point, right? Okay. So then he says, he talks about like certain trade-offs and he says, blah, 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 because of the Baal Tashchis interdict, it becomes a religious duty of a manufacturer to avoid unnecessary loss, wastage, and spoilage of materials he makes use of in his process. Okay. So he wants to defend this view. So like my, you know, inefficient use of gas in my house is a kind of Baal Tashchis. And then he says that you could get like this maximum kind of efficiency from the idea of Me'ula B'damim. Okay. So he wants to tell us about Me'ula B'damim. What's the idea of Me'ula B'damim? Did anybody see it in the Sugya? This, I think, is really what his argument turns on. Anybody get a chance to look at Me'ula B'damim? So the Torah says that if you have a non-fruit tree and a fruit tree, you got to use the non-fruit tree for the siege equipment, correct? See, in my view, otherwise, if you don't use the non-fruit tree, it's gratuitously wasteful, right? It's gratuitously wasteful to choose a fruit-bearing tree when you could get the same result out of a non-fruit. Like, you're destroying fruits for no reason. That's my reading of that's why it's Derech Hashkasa. Rabbi Levine's trying to say, like, oh, no, that it's about, like, squeezing the maximum value out of the thing, right? So I actually think, pushing back on Zachariah, I actually think you could read, right? So like, why would you destroy the beautiful fruit tree when you could get the same result with a non-fruit tree? That's just derech hashchasa on the fruits. That's my reading of it. But Rabbi Levine here is going to make a really radical claim. The Gemara talks about a Me'ula B'damim case. And that's a case where you could get more value out of the non-fruit tree by putting it to some other purpose. So let's say like, it's like a beautiful wood that on the market you can get a lot for it for like house construction. So you could derive more value from the non-fruit tree. So it's more efficient for you to use the fruit tree for the siege equipment. That's the Me'ula B'damim case. Okay. So the Gemara says, and I'm just gonna go back to my source sheet here. The Gemara says, in a case of Me'ula B'damim, imhaya Me'ula B'damim, mutter. Okay. And the way the Gemara cashes that out, so meaning if the non-fruit bearing tree is worth more, then it's mutter to chop down the fruit bearing tree. Notice that phrase, mutter. Okay. permissible. Tanya Nami Hachi, why does the Gemara say Eitz Asher Teda and Kiloiz Machalhu? Lahakdim Srak Lemachal. To teach you that you have to use a non-fruit bearing tree fruit. Yachal Afila Mu'ula Bedamim. What if the non-fruit bearing tree is worth more? Talmud Lomar Rak. So if the non-fruit bearing tree is worth more, chop down the fruit bearing tree or something like that. Now, the critical question here is when the Gemara concludes this way, is it just a Hofeldian permission? It's like a license to choose either one. As the Gemara says, mutter, it's permissible to chop down the fruit-bearing tree. Or is the Gemara's maskana here that it's a Hofeldian duty? You're obligated to chop down the fruit-bearing tree because you could extract more value out of the non-fruit-bearing tree. Do you see that? So that's kind of the question that Rabbi Levine is going to focus on. And he's going to say that there's a view in the Rishonim that thinks you're obligated to chop down the fruit tree in order to extract the greater value out of the non-fruit-bearing tree. Pretty cool proof, right? So he says over here on page 161 of the article, Rav Menachem Ha-Meiri and others understand the circumstances to refer to the instance where the bulwark, the siege equipment, can be effectively constructed from either the fruit tree or the wild tree. But the wild tree is more valuable in an alternative use than the value of the fruit tree. Halacha here mandates use of the fruit tree. That's his interpretation of the sugya of Me'ula B'damin. So halacha mandates the use of the more efficient, like the more efficient allocation of resources. Even though you're going to be destroying the fruit tree. And he says, summarizing this, interpreting the condition in this fashion transforms Baal Tashchis into an efficiency mandate. Construction of the bulwark must be accomplished by means of the least cost method. Since the wild tree is more valuable than the fruit tree, minimizing the cost of constructing the bulwark requires the use of the fruit tree for this purpose. Then he generalizes, by extension, any material substance may not be transformed to something else unless the transformation represents the least cost method of achieving the given objective. Whoa, pretty powerful moves here, right? We start off with Baal Tashchis's Derech Hashchasa. He says, no, you got to look more carefully into the sugya, right? So he makes Zachariah's move and he says, chopping down the fruit tree would help you. But the halacha says you got to chop down the non-fruit tree. Otherwise it's wasteful. So that speaks to one kind of efficiency. My response to that is not so quick. I think you could easily say that chopping down a fruit tree when you could get the same result with a non-fruit tree is maybe it's like just morally destructive. It's like wrongful to chop down a nice fruit tree for no purpose. Fine. Then he goes further and says, in the case where you could get more value out of the non-fruit tree, the Meiri thinks you have a duty to chop down the fruit tree. And that shows that the halacha here just cares about efficiency, right? What he calls the least cost method. Everybody on board with his analysis? Okay. And throughout the article, he runs with this idea. He says later on, the lost leader thing, all that stems from his analysis of the Me'ula B'damim idea. So far, so good? Okay, did anybody look up his sources? Zachary, you looked up the Meiri that he relies on? So
yeah, we did.
You did?
Yeah.
Okay, good. So I want to say something first. I want to say, first of all, you should always check people's sources. Number two, I want to say that I had a second thought that just popped out of my head. It's going to come back to me in a minute. But I think if as presented, his argument is pretty good, right? But the second point I wanted to make is it does raise a methodological question. Even if he has the Meiri, it's an interesting question when you have Machlokas Rishonim, right? Most Rishonim are pretty clear that it's just a Hofeldian permission. to chop down which tree you want. So it's like an interesting question, like is like the, when you're articulating the foundational principles of halacha, is it sufficient that you could rely on these, like the shita of the Meiri against what he calls the other shitas that he's shown him? I think he acknowledges that like the Rima Luniel explicitly says it's just a rishus to chop down whichever tree you want. I'm pretty sure the Rima Luniel said that. Here's the Rima Luniel explicitly on Lamed Beis and Dapei Arif. Yacham Ula Bedamim, etc. Tamid Lomar Rak. Meaning it's just a Hofeldian permission. It's a Hofeldian liberty that you could chop down whichever tree you want. You're not obligated to go for the least cost method. So it's an important question. I'm a chokish rishonim like this, which one speaks for the halachic theory? But let's look at the Meiri, which is the Meiri and the Shittim Kubetzes, which is analysis lies on. I think if you look at the footnote on page 161 and 162, it's footnote, I think, 10. He points us to the Meiri on Sadi Aleph and the Shittim Kubetzes on Sadi Aleph, B'Shem Lagon. So Zechariah and Noah, in your view, do these sources support his contention that you have a duty to use the that you have a duty to use the fruit tree if you could extract more value out of the non-fruit tree?
Zechariah?
Noah?
Initially you thought, yes, Zechariah raised the possibility that his lashon of manichin might not be so airtight. I'm looking at it again now as it is on the sheet, and I'm a little bit more convinced. It's an unpopular view. I don't know.
Okay, good. So yeah, I think the Meiri is complicated. You know, when the whole argument here hangs on a Meiri and the Gaon, you want to make sure that like his reading is correct. I think there's an ambiguity in Hebrew. We saw this in our Rambam, for example. So the Meiri says, Hayashel Srak Meula Lebinyan Elatoran, Ushvacho Ole Leyeser Al Shevach HaPeros. Everybody see this on my screen? So you could extract more value out of the non-fruit tree. Shel Oso Amid Lamachel, Manichin Eshel Srak Bekorsin Eshel Machel, Umishtam Shinbo. So he's reading Manichin as a duty. Right, you're obligated to pass over the non-fruit bearing tree and to chop down the fruit bearing tree. I think I'm not like an expert in language. I'm pretty sure in Hebrew, manichin is ambiguous between you ought to and it's permissible for you. If you go back to our sugya, the Rambam said, like sheyochal haperos mima sheoved behem. That's, you know, it's not a duty for the poel to eat the fruits that he's working on. It's a permission. Does this ring familiar? Everybody remember the Rambam's formulation in our sugya? Hebrew is just ambiguous between what's a command or what's an obligation and what's a permission in some cases. And I think in the Meiri here also, it's ambiguous whether manichin is a duty or a mere permission. But notice the next line in the Meiri. And I think this is dispositive. It's decisive. Me'ata kol sheyesh hefsid ba'amida se'ilon afal pi shehu shel machol mutter lekotzitzo. He says, well, if leaving the tree, one of the trees up is going to cause you a loss, then it's permissible to chop it down. So doesn't that clearly show that his sense of menichin is a mere permission rather than an obligation? No?
I'm not convinced. He's talking about a totally different case. He's talking about like where you have a tree in like a vineyard and it's like ruining the grapes a little bit. You could just do nothing. Here it's where like the prior case is where you're choosing between one tree and another. The latter case is like, okay, is it usher for me to cut this tree down or is it mutter? I don't know.
He does say me'ata. Me'ata is coming off the previous din, no?
Not sure which part it's coming off of.
I mean, it could be from the efficiency thing, as in just like, oh, since it's a mitzvah, since you can... you're allowed to do things if it's more efficient. Since grapes are worth more than, you know, my date tree, I can cut down my date tree.
So you think that this phrase here, manichin, is not following from the srak mula bedamim comparison? See, the way I read it is that he says, Hayashel Strach Mu'ul Labinin blah 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 Shvacha Oli Yasser Alperos. So the oak tree is worth more than the fruit tree. So Manichin Eshel Strach, I read that as it's permissible for you to leave the Shel Strach, and you could chop down the Shel Machol. We see from here that anytime you lose money by leaving up one of the trees, even if it's Shel Machol, so you just Mutter Lekotzitzo. Right? You have a permission to chop down the fruit-bearing tree if it's going to come at a loss for you to keep it up. So it's not a duty of efficiency. It's a license in consideration of like the financial loss you'd otherwise suffer. Gabe, you have a thought on this?
Yeah, I disagree with Zachariah's reading, but I agree with Zachariah's conclusion. I would have thought or the relevant question here is Aser versus Mutter, that Aser is Baal Tashkes Aseitza. And so we need to know whether you're allowed to cut down this tree. So Miri is just telling us it's Mutter. I don't think that necessarily decides the question as to whether this is the preferred route or not.
Interesting. You guys at least agree that Manichin is open to interpretation? Or are you committed to, like Zolt, are you committed to, Zolt, you're like the hardliner here. Are you committed to saying that Manichin means it's a duty to forego chopping down the
Elon? I need more evidence. I think that I don't know. I'm not sure. I think I would have assumed like Roy Levine and Manichin apply some type of duty, but I'm not sure that. But I understand your like argument. I'm not. I'd have to. I need more evidence. I just don't know enough grammar. But I agree with like Zachary or Gabe's reading. I don't really get the difference honestly between two of them. But about the fact that the next line doesn't imply that there's that there's like just like a heter with regard to choosing which. It's about whether we want to cut down anything.
See, I read this as saying, you see from here that it's permissible to chop down the fruit-bearing tree when it's going to come at a loss to you. So that's like a summary of the previous, right? He's saying...
Yeah, but I think the alternative is not mutter because it's mutter to do this one instead of that tree. I think it's mutter to cut this tree as opposed to not cutting anything at all.
Yeah.
That's what he's saying.
Which is, Yakir, do you have thoughts? Yeah, I hear that. But let me just say this to both... I think like you have such a radical conclusion of the article, right? About that's hanging so much on this Mi'iri Mu'ula B'damim thing. Like it's all premised on like a controversial read of the Mi'iri, right? This thing, the Shitas of Mi'iri is doing so much work, but it's like a tenuous read even of the Mi'iri. Yakir, you have a thought on this? Yakir, for saying that.
Yeah. I'm with you that it seems tenuous. And I didn't have a chance to look at this so much beforehand. But I mean, I would agree with Zacharia that I'm not sure mutter is dispositive. That being said, if we're gonna focus the Meiri on just the question of whether it's us or mutter to cut down the fruit tree, then that also means that there's less to be read into the word manichin. In which case I don't see it as strong evidence.
All right. I would say
I'm trying to look at the Rabbi Levine piece. Is it clear that this is that he sees this as this Meiri as the source of the whole principle that there is a mandate of efficiency, or he's just assuming that I don't think he means to use the Meiri in the way that you're trying to say he's using it.
Okay, I thought if you look at page 162, he says, here, I'll pull it up again. He says over here, given the biblical source of Baal Tashchis, Meiri's understanding of Mu'ula B'damim as consisting of a least caught caveat amounts to nothing more than imposing this constraint. Blah, blah, blah. By extension, any material substance not being transformed to something else unless the transformation represents the least cost method of achieving the given objective. Sorry, any material substance may not be transformed into something else unless the transformation represents the least cost method of achieving the given objective. he thinks that like least cost efficiency is what is like that's all proven by this Meiri's position.
Yeah, I mean he's focusing on the Meiri's. He's focusing on, if you go to the previous paragraph, he's focusing on just the Meiri's interpretation of the case, not the Meiri. The Meiri's, what circumstances the Mulodam case refers to. He's focusing on the Meiri's interpretation of the circumstances more than the Meiri's psak of that this is a duty as opposed to a permission.
No, I think when he says this idea that's a least cost caveat means that you have to, that's referring to the duty to use the least cost thing.
Okay, I wasn't reading it that way.
Throughout the article, he repeatedly like appeals again to the Meiri's idea. Let's see the other examples. He comes back to like the here later on, like on. Let's see.
Yeah, I think he thinks the Meiri thinks this. Like I don't think he thinks the Meiri thinks this because the Meiri says it. I think he thinks the Meiri thinks this because the Meiri says, oh, Baltashas no longer applies if it's now the least cost method. And by extension, since Baltashas doesn't just apply to fruit trees but applies to everything, so now everything has this least cost caveat.
Well, look here. You can see here, for example, on the bottom of page.
So it's. I think he thinks that it's just.
Go ahead, Jack. Here, I didn't mean to cut you out.
Okay, cut out for a second again. The bottom of which page?
On the bottom of page 167, he says Meiri's Meula Bedamim criterion has important implications for the modern agricultural setting. This is where he talks about how, like, you can't destroy crops because he thinks it follows here. So he talks about United States farmers have formed to marketing co-ops, blah, blah, blah. Each member agrees not to market any surplus. Heavy penalties are imposed on buyers. Surplus is either sold as animal fodder or is destroyed outright. Meiri's Meula Bedamim criterion puts to question any scheme designed to subsidize farm income by means of destroying surplus crops. So he thinks like there's something about like the Meula Bedamim thing that prevents like you destroying these things for the purpose of like achieving like greater like messing with the supply and demand curves. Noah, you have a hand on this?
Yeah, I just wanted to look at the first paragraph in the Meiri. I thought it might determine the question. I mean, yeah, I just read it too quickly. So the first paragraph in the Meiri, he also uses this kind of like tense in Hebrew that's a little bit, I guess, posed a lot of ambiguity for us. His lashon is, so zesh asra Torah b'matzor shalahashchis eitz ma'achal. So that's specifically if you also have Ilani Srak there. But if you don't have Ilani Srak, then you can cut down the Ma'achal. And then he says, Hayusham shel Ma'achal vishal Srak, makdimin bishal Srak, uksha yichlu eshal Srak, mishtamshim bishal Ma'achal. Sort of like the exact same kind of like tense. But this is exactly the example where there would be an Isser of Baltashchis. Is that a fair read, or am I like reading it incorrectly?
Today, makdimin here means like you ought to be makdim.
Yeah, and if you aren't makdim, that's a violation.
So you're saying here it's got to be an obligation.
Yeah, not just an obligation, but like an actual like it would be a law if you didn't do it.
And you think that supports the reading this tense over here as the same kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't know.
And the mutter thing you dismiss?
I'm not sure what I do with it.
Yeah.
Probably. I don't know. I just thought it was like interesting that he uses the same kind of like formulation previously, but it's got to be like the like actual iser.
In the first case.
Yeah.
That is interesting. Yeah, Kira, you have a comment on this?
Yeah, I want to try to attack this from a slightly different angle. let's assume the following. One, Baltashkis applies to everything, to all these resources, money, whatever. The application is not limited to fruit trees, right? It's very wide ranging, which is a point there. But Levine, I think, demonstrated. Has demonstrated already. And two, that the Meiri is saying that that Baltashkis no longer applies, meaning there's a heter in the situation in which your destruction is the least cost method of obtaining your result.
Which is that's my reading.
So doesn't it automatically follow? Yeah, doesn't it automatically follow that there's now a duty to do it that way? Because if you do it any other way, you're violating Baltashkis on that other thing, because that other thing is not the least cost method, and therefore Baltashkis is in full force.
No, it's because not derech hashchasa, right? The point is that it's not considered like gratuitously destructive.
What's
like the bad guy in Toy Story, Sid, who just likes destroying his toys, right? So you're not.
So like, why is it?
That's Baltashkis, right? But like, so right, like that's the kind of bad destruction the Torah has in mind, and that's not captured by a case where, you have an oak tree that's like really valuable on the market, so you could chop down your olive tree instead to make the fortification.
Well, okay, but I think Rabbi Levine would object that there that it's like why is chopping down the fruit tree when the fruit tree is more valuable, that is derech hashchasa, but cutting down the oak tree when the oak tree is more valuable is not derech hashchasa? Like that seems to be an artificial distinction. I think Rabbi Levine would suggest that the most reasonable reason derech hashchasa is just that it's not the least cost method on the Meiri's reading.
See, I think not. I think the idea is that there's the Torah values like certain commodities, like, oh, you have like a beautiful olive tree, to like chop that down when you just as easily could use like the tree that doesn't have the same kind of value to you. That's considered like, why would you destroy like the thing that the Torah values, like the good fruit tree?
Again, like you're assuming that there's some relevance of that fruit trees are special, that Baltashkis somehow applies more to fruit trees than to other things. Like the Torah cares more about fruit trees than other things, which is possible. But I think Rabbi Levine just doesn't believe in that. I think that at the beginning of the article, he sort of dismissed that because halacha applies it equally to everything.
Well, I don't think he established, even in the beginning, he talked about breaking kalim, tearing garments, destroying an animal. You know, those all fit within Sid and Toy Story, right? You know, the one example that, you know, leans closer in this direction is like causing a lamp to burn faster. But I want to take a look at that example to see how persuasive it is for note 5. But I don't think it's true that you could just generalize that it applies to everything. Yakir.
Okay. I mean, I agree that there's maybe an argument that way. I think that on your reading, you have to do like a lot of fancy footwork to figure out like it applies, like derech hashchasa is going to be defined differently with respect to different objects.
The Rima Luniel is explicit about reading the sugya this way. I mean, he says the Eza Sheyirtz Yiktos. That's the Rima Luniel's reading of the sugya.
I agree that there's such a reading. I'm just trying to demonstrate that, you know, at least if you assume that least cost is a factor, at least in Heter, it's harder to limit it to being a Rima Luniel like permission than it is for it just to extend to being a full force duty. I think that it's a much cleaner it's a, from a looking at the applicability of Altashkas as a whole, you get a much cleaner, simpler scope of application if you assume that it applies equally to everything, and therefore it follows that it's always going to be a duty to choose the least cost one.
Interesting. Did you see the chat that Zakaria and Noah put in? They're saying that, so you're arguing against me that like my reading makes something special out of fruit trees. And they're saying, well, like the Rambam thinks that the only thing you get malchus for midoraisa is actually fruit trees. So there is, it is like this privileged category, right? Zakaria and Noah, is that the... So the Rambam says, lo ilanos bilvad, kol mishaber kelim, kred begadim, horiz binyan, so semayan, avin machalos derech hashchasa, over below tashchis, the inaloka elamakas mardis midoraim. But deoraisa is only for the, like the fruit tree derech hashchasa. It's interesting. Right, to me, the difference is all about derech hashchasa versus like the inefficiency that he talks about, and just the empirical question is whether the Meiri is strong enough to like bear the burden that he's imposing on it.
Right, right. I think he'll tell you that I don't think he places that burden on the Meiri. I think he places that burden. You know, he already said, like, well, clearly derech hashchasa doesn't mean what you think it means, because the Torah's example is where you're using it for something that you want to use it for.
My point is that is derech, like, from my point, it is derech hashchasa to, like, to use the fruit tree when something else could do that much, you know, just as easily. Right?
Right, and he thinks that, too, because of least cost. And you think that because there's something special about fruit trees. That fruit trees, there's more of a derech hashchasa than there is for other things. So yeah, I think those are both possible readings. I don't think his take on this is as unreasonable and as unsupported as you're making it out to be.
Yeah, fair enough. That's fair. They came out swinging too strong. You know, should heed Shua's caution. You know, should be more charitable here. But okay, so maybe there's some leg for him to stand on. But I would say it's like. His reading is not the maximally persuasive reading of the Meiri, if we were to categorize things that way. Let me just take, I'm going to spend 3 more minutes now. It's crazy how my 20 minutes turned in, or a half hour turned into an hour and a half. Not sure how that happened. I hope it's not derech hashchasa. But let me just, I want to make just like 2 other points here in the article. Maybe these are also less, not so charitable. But if you look on page 171. Okay. Let's see. Gabe, what are you, shocked about the time. On page 171, Rabbi Levine says, so he talks about efficiency obligations halacha imposes on a businessman in a competitive environment. Did anybody read that section? So I think it's a total misrepresentation of what's going on in the sugya. Basically what he does is he says that because of the dinim of hasagas gvul, I know Shua was interested in hasagas gvul. So this is the move that he makes, okay? The structure of the argument from 171 to 172 is that halacha will generally not protect somebody in a hasagas gvul case if the reason why they're being put out of business is because they're inefficient. They're not being efficiently productive in their business. It's like the business is wasteful in some way. His reading is actually a pretty novel reading of the sugya. He cites this din that the Gemara has of one person's allowed to give out nuts to entice people to come to a store because the other person could also just give out almonds. It's like, if I could advertise, you could advertise, so you can't have a taina on me for advertising. He takes this to mean that the halacha will not enjoin somebody from competing with you if the reason why their competition is putting you out of business is because you're inefficient, okay? So the idea is that like the halacha generally will protect your store from a competitor, unless the reason why your store is going out of business is because you're running it inefficiently. I mean, that sounds pretty reasonable on the face of it, right? So like if I'm Golan and I'm trying to restrict like the hamburger bar or whatever it is, if the reason why Golan is bleeding money is because they're, you know, just dumping out tons of extra food at the end of the day, we tell the owner of Golan to, you know, just got to become more efficient. Right? You have no claim against the burger grill place if you're being inefficient. So Rabbi Levine then says, this is a little wild. He says on 172, given this fact, given that correctable inefficiency halakhically invalidates a firm's petition for protection, okay, neglecting its managerial function amounts to conduct that carries with it a self-imposed poverty potential. So it's like, if we're not going to protect your business in cases where you're going to be inefficient, you might become poor. Well, it's usher for you to become poor. And he cites Rashi, who says, "Efes kiloye b'cha evyon," that Rashi says, you got to be, it's like a mitzvah to make sure that you don't become poor. So he says, combine these two ideas, you get an obligation to be efficient. By Yeshua. Freilich and Chanukah. We'll see you hopefully on Thursday, yeah? Still pre-Chanukah then. Right. So the argument here, I think, what do you think of this argument? It's a pretty clever argument, but I think it doesn't establish what he wants to establish. All it shows is that if you don't want to be run out of business, you got to be efficient. If there happens to be a competitor in the market, and if you're going to become poor by not having a business, you know, not every business, this is failure is going to lead to poverty. So what he's doing here is that he's pointing to some structural facts about when the halacha will enjoin competition, and then saying that, oh, therefore, because this might result in poverty, you have like a halachic duty to be efficient. That's like too clever by a half in my book. No? What do you think of this? And you could read through it more carefully, but that's the structure of his argument on 171 to 172. And then the last point
I'm missing something. Why do we need a Sagut Gevul for that? If it's just like, if it's just saying if there's an Isser to become poor, then shouldn't you just say like, it's just like there's a mitzvah then to be successful in business, and like being efficient is like a key component of being successful in business. Like, why do you need a Sagut Gevul at all?
I think it's because that last point. He's trying to show why is efficiency a condition for being successful in business? So he's trying to get at that through the competition rules. Like, otherwise you'll lose to a competitor. I think that's...
But I'm saying you don't need any of that. You can just say as like a maxim, like being inefficient, like leads to become poorer, and that itself is a misser. So.
Yeah, but notice, by the way, two things with respect to that. Notice that it's becoming poor that's the isser, not being inefficient. Just that inefficiency happens to lead in some cases to your being poor, but not in all cases, right? I mean, if I'm rich and I have a business that I upkeep for fun, there's no obligation to be efficient in that case, right? So the obligation, this is like the first examples we spoke about. The obligation is really about, the moral consideration is poverty, not efficiency per se. So I don't think there's much bite to this part of the argument. The last point I wanted to mention is the whole last section on 178 to 180, where he talks about the dinim of a worker, which we spoke about in the last Chabura. He talks about the efficiency requirements that halacha imposes on the worker, not idling on the employer's time. And he kind of reviews the dinim that we saw a little bit about, you know, the short in Shmoneh Esrei and not being Meshiv Shalom and not standing up for Talmidei Chachamim, the shortened benching, all of those dinim that we saw, the worker not moonlighting. And he talks about these as like the efficiency requirement that the halacha imposes on the worker. And look how he sets this up even. another aspect of the efficiency requirement that halacha imposes on the worker is the prohibition of idling on the employer's time. To my mind, that's not like about efficiency per se. It's not about the productivity of resources that he spoke about like in the beginning of the article about ex-efficiency and the duty of the firm to be efficient. This is just about gezel malachto shabala bayis. Again, granted, in our sugya, we saw tensions in bitul malacha or gezel malachto shabala bayis or bitul malachto shabala bayis. So I think that's an interesting question to explore. But in the actual dinim that he discusses, these are all just about stealing from your employer. And to my mind, that has nothing to do with efficiency in and of itself as a value. That shouldn't fall under the category of the chapter of economic efficiency in Jewish law. The haraya, like if you're working for yourself, we don't say cut out your shmoneh esrei. We don't say don't daven. As Zecharia pointed out, even for a kablon, right, these dinim don't apply. So it's hard for me to see how these are about efficiency per se when they're really about gezel. So to summarize the discussion that took us, I guess, all of Chabura today. So I think the project is really interesting. I think it's a very important project, like question, like what is the halacha's, how much value does halacha put on economic efficiency? It's a very important question to pursue, as kind of as Shua said at the outset. I think in Rabbi Levine's particular analysis, it's problematic for three reasons here. Number one, I think his analysis of the Baal Tashchis sugya, again, in my view, I know we could debate some of the particular readings, the sugya sustains a reading that Derech Hashchasa is problematic, looks like Sid in Toy Story. I think there's a wide chasm has to be crossed to get to his allocative efficiency and ex-efficiency. Maybe he has a Me'iri. In my view, even the Me'iri is just a Rishus. And that's all about what constitutes Derech Hashchasa, not about efficiency per se. So I think that's problem number one for his analysis. In the other parts of the article, I think they're problematic because you have to distinguish between economic efficiency as a value in and of itself and poverty being the real moral consideration, just efficiency being some lack of efficiency might lead to a condition of poverty. So I think the mere fact that lack of efficiency might affect the rules of Hasagas Gvul such that you'll end up poor, or you might end up poor, that doesn't show that halacha values efficiency in and of itself. And then regarding the last section of the article, I think those are all interesting cases of gezel malachto shabala bayis. But gezel malachto shabala bayis is about contractual obligations, about kinyanim, not about efficiency. So I think it's a great project, methodologically problematic. And then again, in the substance of the analysis, it doesn't meet the promissory note that he gives us right at the outset of the article, where he says, just to borrow his phrase, that he's going to show us that Jewish law mandates the practice of efficiency as a religious duty. So I don't think that kind of conclusion is justified by the piece. Closing thoughts on this? Brief, any thoughts? Yoni is probably going to tell us we have to be more sympathetic. Gabe, you're on board with the analysis? Gabe, you agree, right? Yeah, we're getting an affirmative head nod from Gabe. You don't want to unmute yourself and state it for everyone.
For the recording, everybody should know that I agree with Ravitina.
There you go. Gabe and I
are thrown by rap deal by your critiques.
I don't know. We got asked by rap.
Isn't he like the big guy in the basement who's like a big comment over by Levine?
Yeah, well, you saw one of the things I sent out on the WhatsApp is his write up by Levine. So I think there's great work here. I'm not convinced by the project or the argument. So. All right. Any other thoughts? Noah, thoughts on this? You're more or less in agreement, even if you think I should be more sympathetic in the Me'iri reading?
Yeah, that was a very productive, interesting kind of article. I don't know. Yeah.
You thought it was productive to read, or?
Yeah. I learned about Baal Tashchis. That's productive.
Yeah. Okay, good.
No pun intended.
Yeah. Good. So you can see this is the wrap up of the Bitul Malacha part of our sigya. I think we'll spend two chaburas now on Mishalo or Mishal Balabayas Uochel. I would just say review, glance quickly at the honore article again. Just the section where he lists the 11 incidents of ownership. I think that's going to be central to our analysis. Like, which incidents of ownership does the Poel have in his Zechus Achila? Like, what scope of ownership does he have, and how that relates to Mishalo and Mishal Balabayas Uochel? So we're gonna do that. So you're having two chaburas, and then we're gonna move into Kuf Aleph, the Yored L'Tok Sadeh Chaver Mashpicho, and then Shomrim for the next amount of time. All right, sounds good.
You keep pushing off Shomrim. Maybe next year.
No, no. We said Yored is like a 2-3 chabura a hit, and then we have plenty of time for Shomrim.
Did we next Bal Talin?
Oh yeah. Well, did you guys want to do Bal Talin?
Yes, yeah, exactly. That's how we keep pushing it off.
I think we should push off. I think we should push off Bal Talin and BMO. I think that's because it's not. It's an interesting din that's related to Poelim. It's not like Choshen Mishpat Rich. I mean, it's like an interesting Isser. There's not like so much like meaty like Dine Mamonis Bailos questions associated with it. So that's why I think it's, even though it's thematically related to Poelim, I think it's a little bit of it doesn't meet your read works very nicely with some of the Bailos themes we're about to explore and we've been exploring within Zechus Achilas Poel. You don't really get, but there's like in Biyomatid and Tsarn, you get this question of Yashnal Skiros Mitchilav Yad Sof. That's only tangentially related, and if we want to do that well, we're going to get dragged into Yashnal Skiros. So I think it's better just to do Yored, Shomrim, and then if there's time at the end of Shomrim, we can come back to Biyomotit and Sparo.
Can we clarify like what is leading us to look into Yored here? Because that is not clear to me, or will it become clear when we start learning it?
Bye, Gabe. You want to hold off on Yored?
It's not clear to me like why you want to do it now, but maybe it will become clear as soon as I start looking into it.
Zachary, do you want to answer?
I thought it was from that like one Shuddha Rashba where you like, if you refer people into your store, then like the idea of non-contractual contracts or something like that, like Ming Medina Stam.
It did come up there. That's not the motivation for looking into it. It's more that it's pretty fundamental about one of the broad themes that we're going to be seeing across, starting already in this Zechus Achilas Poel through Shomrim, through parts of Mashkon, if we look at any Aveda stuff also, is this question of ownership in Halacha. The different ways that ownership can be specified and which incidents come along with the Bailim's quote-unquote property rights or ownership. And Yore is just a very interesting sugi that sheds light on that. So we'll see it in the Baal B'nichse Ishto discussion in Shomrim. I think the machinery that we're going to develop in Yored will be helpful here for like going forward. So, Jacob, do you have an objection to doing it, or just
no? I have no objection. I trust that there's like a reasoning behind like why to choose the topics in this order. I just it was not transparent to me what that reasoning was.
Yeah, I'm trying to choose the maximally efficient way of getting out the core ideas. So it's a religious obligation on us. All right, shkoyach everyone. Let's pick up on Thursday with our Mishalo or Mishal Balabayas Uochel. Maybe we'll wrap up Mishalo or Mishal Shemayim on Thursday. Unlikely though. But so let's allocate two sigyas, two chaburas for this. Great. Take care, everyone. Bye bye.